Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Stephen L. Kent, Rogue Clown, narrated by Ken Jackson, with performances by Eric Messner, Tim Getman, Richard Rowan, Dylan Lynch, Elliot Dash, Joe Brack, Gary Telds, Thomas Penny, Mort Shelby, Tim Carlin, Nick DePinto, Drew Copas, Yasmin Toison, David Coyne, Danny Gavigan, Thomas Keegan, Christopher Grayville, Jeff Allen, Gregory Gorton, Christopher Sheeran, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, James Konacek, James Keegan, and Colleen Delaney. Rogue Clone, Book 1, The Clone Republic. AD 2510. Location, Ravenwood Outpost. Planet, Ravenwood. Galactic location, Scutum Crux Arm.
You picked a hell of a place to die, Marine.
This planet had no economic value, no strategic value, and no scientific worth. The outpost, with its naked concrete walls, was just a primitive fort on a barren planet surrounded by plains and ice. I looked around at the young Marines posted throughout the halls. These boys were dead, fresh out of basic, loyal to their last breath, and served up to die. Legend had it that space monsters prowled the surface of Ravenwood. Most of my boys believed it was space aliens attacking the fort. Facing their deaths, these boys turned back the clock to the days when authors wrote books about alien invasions. But those authors were wrong. Once we entered space, we discovered that we were almost alone in the galaxy. The only thing man had to fear was man himself. Up ahead, a couple of my boys knelt in the shadow of a doorway and prayed.
You do that. You pray. Why not? Once the guns are loaded and the troops in place, God and chance are all you have left.
AD 2508, Gobi Station.
Name?
Sergeant Godfrey barked the question without bothering to look up from his desk. Private First Class Wason Harris, reporting as ordered, sir. I saluted, then handed him the sealed file that contained my orders.
PFC Harris.
I shouldn't have saluted. Once you leave basic training, you only salute officers or Marines acting under command authority. You don't salute sergeants, and you certainly don't call them sir, but it's a hard habit to break. Having just spent 3 months living the spit-and-polish discipline of boot camp, I had come to fear drill sergeants for the gods they were.
PFC Harris, PFC Harris, let's see what we have here.
The sergeant broke the red strip sealing my files. He flipped through the pages, occasionally stopping to scan a line. Apparently having found what he wanted, he spread the file on his desk.
Fresh out of recruit training, a 1 in combat readiness? I've never seen anyone score under 400.
It's a performance ranking, sir.
You say something, Private?
That number was my school rank. I drew top marks in hand-to-hand combat and marksmanship.
Son of a bitch, perfect scores. Why waste a perfectly good Marine on a shithole planet like this? You have a problem following orders, Harris?
No, sir.
I was, in fact, quite obedient by human standards. The military, however, had considerably higher standards. Most conscripts came out of clone farms that the government euphemistically referred to as orphanages. Designed specifically for military life, the clones raised in these orphanages reacted to orders by reflex, even before their conscious minds grasped what they'd been asked to do. As a natural-born human, I could not compete with their autonomic obedience. My brain took a moment to sort out orders.
My inability to react to orders without thinking had caused me problems for as long as I could remember. I grew up in a military orphanage. Every child I knew was a clone. I might have entered Unified Authority Orphanage Number 553 the old-fashioned way, by having dead parents, but as a resident of UAO 553, I grew up with 2,000 clones.
Your file says that you were slow following orders.
It's comparing me to clones.
Did you spec some officer's daughter?
No, sir.
No. Just wondering why they wasted a perfectly good recruit on a planet like this.
Random assignment, I suppose, sir?
Sure. Well, Private First Class Harris, I am Glenn Godfrey. You can call me Glenn, Godfrey, or Gutterwash. Do not call me Sir. Gobi is pretty much a long-term assignment. Get sent here, and you're stuck for life. As long as you know that I am the sergeant, and therefore the one you obey, you can forget everything they taught you in basic.
Growing up in an orphanage, you learn how to spot clones. They're all cut from the same helix. With Gutterwash Godfrey, however, I could not readily tell. He had sun-bleached blonde hair that nearly reached his shoulders. Every clone I had ever known had brown hair and an assembly line flat-top haircut. Godfrey pressed a button on his console.
Got a rack?
Fresh meat arrive.
Or a reasonable facsimile.
Send him down. I'll put him in Hutchins's old rack.
Hutchins? Shipped out?
Nope.
Killed in action?
Nope. Suicide. Corporal Dahlmer will meet you down that hall.
Thank you, sir. I wasted another salute.
The sooner you lose that, the better we'll get along.
I grabbed my two travel cases. I had clothes and toiletries in one bag. The other bag held my gear. One helmet, a complete set of body armor, one body glove, one weapons and gear belt, one government-issue particle beam pistol with removable rifle stock, one government-issue M27 pistol with removable rifle stock, and one all-purpose combat knife cum bayonet with 7-inch diamond blade. Halfway down the hall, I stopped to stare at my surroundings. Judging by the name, Gobi, I knew it was an early settlement. The cartographers used to name planets after Earth locations in the early days of the expansion. That was before the science of terraformation passed from theoretical possibility to common practice. The open-air hall from Godfrey's office to the barracks buzzed with flies. One side of the hall overlooked a stagnant pool of oily water surrounded by mud and reeds. I noticed the tail end of an animal poking out through the reeds. As I looked closer, I realized that it was an Earth-bred dog, a German Shepherd, and that it was lying dead on its side.
Don't worry, we run that through filters before we drink it.
Like Godfrey, this man wore his armor and body glove without his helmet. The environmental climate control in the bodysuit must have felt good.
We drink that?
You either drink that or buy water from the locals. The locals jack you. You could blow a full week's pay buying a glass of water from them. Only Gutman has that kind of money. That sludge doesn't taste bad once you strain it. Name's Tron Dahmer. Whatever you did to get stationed here, well, welcome to the asshole of the friggin' universe. Did Gutterwash mention that we here at Gobi Station are the few and the proud?
No.
This here is the smallest marine outpost in the whole damn UA Empire.
How many men?
Including you, 41. The good news is that you don't have to share your room. The bad news is that if the locals ever decide they don't like us, they could trample our asses out of here. Of course, they barely notice us. Even with you, we're one man shy of a full platoon. Besides, they're so busy with their own wars, they hardly notice us.
So there is some action out here.
Fresh out of boot and in a rush to kill, eh?
I would hate to think that I wasted my time in boot camp.
You wasted it, Harris. We have standing orders to stay out of local feuds.
Dahmer led me into the barracks, an ancient building constructed of thick sandstone blocks with rows of modern dormitory cells wedged into its bulky framework. Each cell was designed to house 4 people, but no one lived in the cells on this floor. The doors hung open, revealing dusty quarters. A thin layer of sand covered the floor, and I saw twisting trails where snakes had slithered.
You can have this entire floor to yourself if you want. Most of us prefer the bottom floor. It's cooler in the summer. Cooler in the winter, too.
I take it this is summer?
Boy, this is the dead of winter. Why do you think everybody's got their helmets off? We want to enjoy the cool air while it lasts.
The only light in the chamber came from windows carved in the meter-thick walls. As my eyes adjusted, I saw hundreds of particle beam pistols piled in one corner of the floor.
Broken. Sand gets in the housing and scratches the mirrors, leaves them worthless.
Why don't you change out the mirrors?
Fix them? Gobi Station used to be the outermost armory on the Cygnus arm. We have 1,000 guns for every man on this base. Make that 2,000. We use them for shooting lizards. It's easier to grab a new gun than to requisition replacement parts. Hell, Harris, it's been 2 years since anybody's even been out to the firing range. This is Gobi. Of course, we can't just throw broken weapons away or the locals will steal them. Godfrey dumped a load once. I think we armed half the planet.
Are there problems with the locals?
Not much. Some of them consider themselves gunslingers, but it's all petty stuff. I doubt the Senate loses much sleep over Gobi. That was Hutchins's cell over there.
The door swung open at my touch, and I immediately knew that someone, likely Dahmer or Godfrey, had searched through Hutchins' belongings.
How long has this room been empty?
2, maybe 3 months. Did Godfrey tell you about Hutchins?
Only that Hutchins committed suicide.
Put a goddamn particle beam pistol in his mouth, set his goddamn brain on fire.
Dahmer left, and I set up my quarters. Using a blood-stained sheet I found, wadded in a drawer, I wrapped the late Private Hutchins' belongings into a tight ball and stuffed them in a corner of the room.
Why am I here? Why the hell am I here?
The only time we met as a platoon was at breakfast. Once or twice per week, Glan Godfrey briefed us about recent communiques from Fleet Headquarters as we ate. Nobody listened during Godfrey's briefings. We were as far from Fleet Headquarters as you could get without leaving the galaxy, and nothing Command had to say seemed of any significance out here. On most days, the platoon divided up after breakfast. Godfrey and Dahmer generally hung around the base, God knows why. The rest of the platoon piled into a couple of trucks and rode into town. They generally returned before supper. I think they wanted to stay out later, but the locals closed shop before sundown. I spent my first month jogging around the outside wall of the base, holding target practice at the firing range, and trying to convince other men to join me. Most of the men laughed at the idea of drilling. Godfrey and Dahmer would not even discuss it. One corporal, Lars Rickman, came out and trained with me twice, but he quickly lost interest. After 6 weeks, I gave up on training alone and took my first trip into Morrow Town. Godfrey congratulated me on having more starch than Hutchins. The last new recruit before me, Hutchins stopped training after less than 1 week. Life around the outpost became friendlier after I said I would go to Morrow Town. Located a mere 200 miles west of our outpost, Morrow Town had 60,000 residents. On Gobi, it was the big league. A word about our trucks. They were open-air transports with no armor and no guns.
Shouldn't these have guns or rockets mounted on them?
What? Why?
Rickman was the only man stationed on Gobi who even partially resembled a Marine. Not only had he at least attempted to train with me, he still polished his armor and carried a sidearm. He was a clone, of course. All of the other Marines on Gobi were clones. Like Godfrey, Rickman had bleached hair and a gaunt face. The only Marine that Gobi had not made thin was Taj Gutman. Gutman had grown so fat that he no longer fit into his armor. Godfrey referred to Gutman as Four Cheeks, meaning he had enough ass for two men. The name stuck, and everybody used it. As the new kid on base, I got to sit next to Gutman as we drove to Morrow Town. Until I arrived on Gobi, I assumed that all Marines trained hard and obeyed the rules. Of course, none of these Marines knew they were clones. Straight out of the tube, combat clones had brown hair and brown eyes, but through the miracle of neural programming, they thought of themselves as natural-born people with blonde hair and blue eyes. That was how they saw themselves, too. When clones looked at themselves in the mirror, they saw blonde hair and blue eyes. God knows how the scientists pulled that off, but they did. And since clones were also hardwired not to speak about cloning among themselves, orphanages managed to raise thousands of clones without one clone telling the next he was synthetic. Growing up, I used to eat in a cafeteria with thousands of identical cadets who never mentioned that everybody around them looked and sounded precisely alike. They could eat, shower, and shave side by side and not see the similarities they shared with the men next to them because of cerebral programming in their DNA. Even though they knew everyone else was a clone, they never suspected their own synthetic creation. Around the orphanage, people used to say that clones were wired to self-destruct if they ever understood the truth of their origin.
Hey, you ever played poker? That's a great game. Laying your cards and catching everyone flat-footed. Oh, there is no better feeling.
I've never played.
Yeah, well, you stick with me, you'll make a fortune.
Not having much to say to Gutman, I watched the desert as we drove. All I saw was sand and rock and clear blue sky. The ride lasted 2 hours. 2 hours trapped with Gutman. I was ready to hop off the truck and walk after the first hour. By the time we finally saw the city, my head hurt from all of Gutman's babbling. Built almost entirely out of sandstone bricks, Marltown blended into its environment. I saw the shapes of the buildings long before I realized what they were.
Here we are.
I hate these trucks.
With few words spoken, the platoon divided into groups. Some men went to a saloon where they got drunk on a daily basis. They could not afford clean water, but whiskey and beer were in the budget. Others quietly kept girlfriends in town. Not wanting a generation of half-clone children, unified authority scientists designed clones that were sterile, but that did not mean they left out the sex drive.
Come with me. I'll get you into the best game in Morrowtown. Leave your helmet in the truck. It makes you look silly.
I think I'll keep it on just the same.
Well, suit yourself, but you're gonna scare the locals.
But nobody seemed scared of me. The people ignored us. Children played happily as we passed them on the street. A gang of teenagers stood on a sidewalk flipping coins against a wall. They paused to stare at us, then went on gambling.
It shouldn't be like this. They should be a little afraid of us.
Ah, good. Taj Gutman. Excellent.
A short man with a round body and a head that was as bald as an egg approached us. He could not have been taller than 5'2".
Klein, you are early today. And you have brought a friend. We have another visitor today as well. Come in.
Klein led us into the gambling establishment.
This ugly mutt is Klein. And Klein, this is Harris. Sorry about the helmet. I told him that it makes him look silly.
I'm just here to watch.
Watch? This game is for players only.
Oh, he'll play.
Perhaps I should leave then. I've never played, and from everything Gutman tells me, this is no game for beginners.
Nonsense! Of course he'll play.
Well, I wish you would. I'm new at the game myself, and I hate the idea of getting swindled alone.
A tall man with thinning white hair and a well-trimmed beard stepped out from the shadows along the wall.
You must have money to burn. Gutman here is a card shark.
Is he?
It's all just in fun.
I'm living on enlisted man wages, and my next check does not arrive for a week. I doubt I even have enough cash to buy my way into the game.
You may wager your weapon. Sidearms are as good as cash at this table.
What was that?
Don't worry, I never come here with cash.
I think I'm in the wrong place.
I have no objection to your watching the game.
Well, what do you say, Klein?
Sit behind Gutman, and no walking around. And I insist that you check your weapon.
And don't worry, it'll be safe. You cannot go anywhere in Morrowtown wearing your sidearm.
Though I did not like the idea, I unstrapped my holster and handed it to Klein. The seven men closed in around a large round table. I sat in a chair behind Gutman and watched as Klein dealt each player 5 cards, 2 facing up and 3 facing down. Gutman slipped his pudgy thumb under the corner of the 3 downturned cards and peered at their values. When he bent the corners to have a look, I saw that he had 2 threes and an ace on the table. The cards that had been placed face up were a king and a 6. Gutman slid the ace, the king, and the 6 forward. Klein collected each man's rejected cards and replaced them with cards from the deck. As Gutman fanned out his new cards, I saw that he had added a face card, a 10, and another 3. The bids went around the table. When it came to Gutman, he pushed his pistol into the center of the table, and Klein handed him a tray covered with chips. The man with the beard looked pleased as well.
Well, this is a rare pleasure.
The man spilled a stack of gold-colored chips on the table.
I'll raise you.
Gutman carelessly tossed a stack of chips into the pot. Some of the other players placed their cards on the table face down and backed out of the game.
Very aggressive move. I have three kings.
Gutman leaned back in his chair as the man raked in his winnings, including the pistol.
Do all soldiers carry these?
And mostly we carry M27s, like the one Harris was wearing. I prefer the particle beam, though. It's worth a lot more money.
Quite a hefty weapon. It must be very sturdy.
You know, you think so, but they don't do so well in the desert. We have piles of broken guns lying around our barracks.
Is that so? Replacements must be easy to come by.
Are you kidding? Gobi Station used to be an armory. His place is a damn munitions depot. Hey, isn't that right?
I did not answer.
I see. So I shall need to take special precautions to keep this in working order.
Klein dealt another hand of cards. This time, Gutman had two queens and a king facing down, with a four and eight facing up. From what I could tell, he was not happy with these cards. As he had done in the last game, Gutman pushed three cards forward, then tossed some chips into the center of the table. Everybody else followed. Klein pivoted around the table a second time, giving Gutman two fives and an ace. A few of the other players grimaced. When Gutman's third bid came, he selected that chip and slid it forward.
I call.
Three of the other players threw down their cards. Klein rolled his slow brown eyes. He looked at his cards, looked at the chips on the table, looked at his cards, and dropped his hand as well.
I'm out.
The bearded man stayed in. Klein proceeded to move around the table, changing cards for the three players who stayed in the game. Gutman took two. So did the man with the beard. Whatever the man got, it made him happy. He grinned and threw a platinum chip and two gold ones onto the table. Gutman's beefy hands hid his cards from my view, but I got the feeling he was strong. His chips were low, and I thought he might need to leave the game.
Let you introduce me.
But Gutman whispered something to Klein, and the dealer handed him another rack of chips. With a wicked grin, Gutman selected three gold chips and tossed them in the pot. Only then did I realize how Gutman had gotten that second rack of chips. He'd wagered my pistol.
It's okay, Harris. I have everything under control.
You are quite the player.
How many?
Two.
Klein leaned forward and took the cards, then dealt new ones. I saw what they were as Gutman inspected them. Two queens. Gutman spilled two-thirds of his chips onto the table.
Ah, unexpected. Wiser men.
With this, he slid Gutman's blaster into the pot.
This sees and raises the stakes, does it not?
You must be pretty confident. Let's see what you have.
The mystery man showed all of his cards. Three kings and two aces.
Oh, crowded house. Nice hand.
Gutman turned over his cards, showing four queens.
But I think the pot is mine.
I would like my pistol.
Don't leave now. I'm just getting my stride. I'm about to clean these suckers dry.
Stepping around Four Cheeks, I grabbed my gun.
Hey, listen, pal.
I'm leaving now.
Glenn Godfrey continued making his cursory announcements every few days as we ate breakfast out of Meals Ready to Eat, MRE, tins. He didn't care if we listened or if we whispered back and forth as he spoke. A couple of weeks after my first visit to Morrowtown, however, Godfrey showed up for breakfast with a regulation haircut and a shave.
All right, men, put down your forks and pay attention.
Godfrey passed around a photograph.
Pictures from home?
Shut up and listen. The entire Central Cygnus fleet is on alert. Command is looking for this man. His name is Amos Crowley. Have any of you grunts seen him?
Dahmer passed the picture my way. Crowley had intense dark eyes, white hair, and a thick white beard. I looked over at Todd Gutman squirming in his seat. We both recognized him, though Gutman clearly did not want to say anything. It was the man from the card game.
What is he wanted for?
The bulletin doesn't say much about what he's done. Crowley is sought for involvement in several seditious activities. The brass in Washington labeled him an enemy of the Republic. Crowley was a general in the army. That makes him special. He was the highest-ranking general in the Perseus arm before he disappeared. Now Washington wants a word with him in the worst way.
He might be here. I saw him 2 weeks ago. One of Gutman's card games.
Are you certain about this, Harris?
Yes.
What about you, Gutman?
Oh, well, it was a while ago. I mean, I guess it looks like him, but I was a...
You festering sack of eye pus. Did you bet your sidearm? Shit, Gutman, you lost your sidearm, didn't you?
I won it back with the next hand.
Shut your spec receptacle. Fleet Command is going to want a full report. I'll be surprised if we don't all end up in front of a firing squad for this, Four Cheeks. Harris, come with me.
Taking short, brisk strides and not saying a word, Godfrey ushered me to his office.
I need you to report what you saw to Fleet Command.
You want me to do it?
I'm not letting Gutman anywhere near Command. Harris, we're in trouble here. Admiral Brocius has taken a personal interest in this hunt. You think I'm going to show him that moron?
Brocius? Vice Admiral Alden Brocius, the highest-ranking officer in the Central Cygnus Fleet, had a reputation for being hard-nosed.
Brocius is personally directing the manhunt. Don't worry about your career, Harris. You're on Gobi. You're already in the shits.
Godfrey crouched in front of his communications console and typed in a code. When the screen flashed, Brocius, a tall and slender man with jet-black hair and brown eyes, stared back at us.
What is it, Sergeant?
Two of my men spotted General Crowley.
I see. You have a positive identification?
Yes, sir. One of the men who identified him is with me now.
Let's have a word with him.
I stepped forward and saluted.
What is your name, son?
PFC Wason Harris, sir.
You saw Amos Crowley?
Yes, sir.
Do you believe he's still on Gobi?
I don't know, sir.
Do you have any reason to believe he's left the planet?
No, sir.
Then you believe he's still on Gobi?
He did not tell the private his plans, sir.
I realize that. Do you think he is still on Gobi?
He may be here, sir.
I see. Very well, then. Put the sergeant back on. Your man does not seem confident. Still, if there's anything to it, I'll send someone to investigate.
Three days after my interview with Admiral Brocius, a beat-up barge appeared in the sky above our base. Lars Rickman and I happened to be standing in a breezeway enjoying the 90-degree morning chill when the ship first appeared. We watched it as it touched down on the loading area beside our outer wall.
What a wreck!
The barge had battered armor. Some of the plates around its cockpit had curled along the edges.
This bitch has been through a war.
As we walked around the rear of the ship, the hatch opened and Ray Freeman emerged, the biggest man I have ever met, standing at least 7 feet tall, with arms and legs as thick as most men's chests. Freeman was a black man. Understand that since the United States brought the world together in a single, unified authority, racial terms like African, Oriental, and Caucasian had become meaningless. Under the unified authority, the Earth became the political center of the galaxy. It wasn't just that Freeman was taller and several shades darker than any man I had ever seen. It was that his biceps were the size of a grown man's skull when he bent his arms, and his triceps looked like slabs of rock when his arms hung straight. Freeman's shaved head was so massive that it looked like he was wearing a helmet. A small knot of scars formed a paisley pattern on the back of his skull. He had a wide nose, which looked as if it had been broken several times, and thick lips.
Who commands this outpost?
That'd be Sergeant Godfrey.
Take me to him.
Without saying a word, Rickman turned and walked straight to Godfrey's office. Relieved to get away from the giant, I stayed back to examine this strange old ship. Rickman returned a few moments later.
Who is he?
I don't know.
I think I'll stay out of his way.
Don't count on it. He sent me out here to get you.
You're joking.
No, I'm not. You get to go meet with Chuckles down in Godfrey's office.
When I reported to Godfrey, I saw Freeman sitting cramped behind the sergeant's desk as if it were his own.
Harris, this is Ray Freeman. He is here on orders from Admiral Brocius.
Here to catch...
He's a mercenary. And a real charmer.
Two men saw Crowley.
The other man was Private Gutman.
Get him.
Go get him, Harris.
You go get him, Sergeant. I want to speak with the private.
Sergeant Godfrey left without looking back.
Remove your helmet.
Freeman placed a folder with the Central Cygnus Fleet seal on the desk.
This is the man you saw?
He pulled a photograph from the top of the folder.
Yes. I saw him enter a poker game in Morrowtown.
You sure? This was the man?
Yes.
Tell me about the game.
I told him about it. When I was done, he reached over and pressed the intercom button on Godfrey's desk.
Send in the other one.
Godfrey and Gutman stepped into the room. Freeman directed Gutman to a chair by the desk with a nod. Once Gutman lowered himself into his chair, Freeman showed him the picture of Crowley.
This the man?
I'm not sure. It may have been him, yeah. It could be him. I really didn't get a good look at that man. I mean, I suppose Harris told you where we saw him?
He mentioned a card game.
Yeah, I see. Well, whoever he was, he wasn't very good at cards. He won the first hand, then I cleaned him out on the second. He quit after the third hand.
What were the stakes?
Morrowtown isn't exactly a gambler's paradise. You might pick home $50 if the locals are feeling dangerous.
I understand you can also win government-issue sidearms.
Oh, yeah, I suppose. I don't think he'd ever seen one before. He held it like he was afraid it would bite him.
Is that the pistol?
Freeman pointed down at Gutman's holster. Gutman fished it out of its sleeve and placed it on the desk. Freeman picked it up between his thumb and forefinger, exactly as Crowley had done.
Is this how he held it?
Yeah, just like that.
Idiot. He shut off the charge guard outtake valve. This pistol will explode the next time you fire it.
What do I do with it? Will it blow up?
Take your weapon and wait in the hall. Harris? You wait outside, too.
Excuse me, sir. I remembered something else. When Gutman lost that first game, he said something about sand ruining these guns. He told Crowley that we had thousands of them around the base.
Freeman looked at me and nodded.
Mm-hmm. That will be all, Harris.
Don't go far.
As I left the room, I found Gutman pacing in the hallway.
Great job, pal. Now I'm in deep.
Gutman... That gun would have blown up in your face if you ever got around to shooting it.
You... Well, yeah, I guess you're right. Do you know how to fix it?
Drain the chamber.
Oh, yeah. Can you help me?
The door opened behind us, and Godfrey peered out.
Harris, Mr. Charming would like another word with you.
As I stepped back into Godfrey's office, I saw Freeman talking to Admiral Brocious on the communications console.
What is your next step?
I want to have a look around Morrowtown.
Keep me informed.
Harris, do you have any civilian clothing?
Sure.
Dress down. I need you to take me into Morrowtown.
The townspeople may have grown accustomed to Marines, but the sight of Freeman sent them running. People hurried out of our way as we walked through the streets. When we got to the gambling house, we found it locked tight.
Do you think anyone is in there?
I don't know.
Good enough for me.
He drew an oversized particle beam pistol from his belt.
We could have knocked.
Freeman did not answer as he disappeared into the smoke. Klein had struck me as somewhat timid the first time I saw him. On this occasion, he went from timid to terrified.
May I help you?
Freeman walked over to Klein and placed the photograph of Crowley on the bar.
We're looking for this man.
He came in a month ago. That was the only time I ever saw him.
What do you remember about him?
He played a few hands and left. That's all I know.
Well, maybe this will jog your memory.
I think he came here looking for soldiers. He asked me if any of the Marines from the base were coming and offered me $100 just to let him join the game.
Anything else?
That's everything.
Never shifting his gaze from Klein's face, Freeman placed his pistol on the bar. Then he reached into a pocket below his chest plate. After fishing around for a moment, he removed a small silver tube.
Your name is Klein, is that right?
Yes.
Do you know how to kill ants, Mr. Klein?
By stepping on them?
Yes. You can kill one ant that way, but I mean a whole hill of ants.
No.
You poison one ant with something slow and highly toxic. You kill it too fast, say, by stepping on it or using a fast poison. All you have is a dead ant. But if you use the right poison, something that works real slow, that ant will infect his entire colony.
Is that poison?
No, sir. Just a little super glue. Now you keep that hand right there. Right like that, Mr. Klein.
Freeman pulled the eyedropper out of the tube and squeezed, forcing several drops of clear white liquid to ooze onto Klein's trembling palm.
See? That didn't hurt. A little glue won't hurt you. Now this could hurt you.
Freeman pulled a grenade from his pocket.
What are you doing?
Freeman closed Klein's fingers around the grenade and held them shut. When he released Klein's fingers, he wiggled the grenade to make sure the glue held fast. Then he pulled the pin from the grenade.
You ever seen one of these? This is a grenade. A high-yield grenade will take out a full city block. This here is a low-yield grenade. Small ones like this aren't nearly so bad. Might only destroy a couple of buildings.
I see.
I made this one just for situations like this. This grenade senses body heat. As long as there are no temperature fluctuations, you'll be perfectly safe. You might want to use the other hand when you grab ice out of that freezer over there. Freezing air would set it off for sure. Don't pry the grenade from your palm. A change in temperature like that will set it off too. You wouldn't want to hit it with a hammer or drill into it either.
I see.
See that hole where I took the pin? If anything goes in that hole except this exact pin, that grenade will explode. Don't stick anything in that hole. You understand?
Yes.
You might lose some skin when I pry the grenade out of your hand.
When?
Think you can remember all that?
When will you take it?
The grenade is set to explode in 48 hours. If I don't see you before then, I guess you can keep it.
But how will I find you? Why are you doing this?
We'll call this an incentive, Mr. Klein. I think you know more information than you are telling me.
How will I find you?
I'll be at the Marine base, Mr. Klein. You come down and visit me if you remember something, but don't wait too long. Don't show up in 47 hours and 59 minutes because I won't want to talk to you.
With that, Freeman packed up his picture of Crowley and his gigantic pistol. He screwed the cover back on the tube and started for the door. I followed. What makes you so sure he's hiding something?
Stop here.
The sun started to set, and the sky above Morrowtown filled with crimson and orange clouds. Lights shone in some nearby windows. Freeman's khaki-colored clothes looked gray in the growing darkness.
How do you know Klein is hiding something?
I'm not sure he is. Now I'm going to track him if he leaves town.
In case he goes to warn Crowley? So, that wasn't a grenade. It was just a tracking device.
No, that was a homemade grenade. I placed a radioactive tracking filament inside the glue.
Freeman turned and walked toward the truck. I followed.
Do you think he is a spy of some sort?
I don't trust him.
Taj Gutman met me at the door of the barracks.
And what happened in town?
Not much.
Did you find Crowley?
No, but Freeman made quite an impression on Klein. That Freeman is a real prick. He glued a grenade to Klein's hand.
Hey, what? So do you think I'm going to get in trouble?
I don't think Freeman cares about you. I don't think he cares about anybody. Just stay out of his way. You'll be okay unless he decides to shoot you.
Klein had a secret, and Freeman must have figured it out. Working with subtle clues that escaped my attention, Freeman pieced that secret together and shared it only with Admiral Brocious, leaving the rest of us unprepared. Looking back, I should have seen it coming. A stockpile of military-grade weapons in a tiny garrison would be too easy a prize for a struggling army of traitors to ignore. Freeman knew that someone like General Crowley would not come to a backwater planet like Gobi for no reason. If Crowley was here and weapons were here, Crowley undoubtedly wanted the weapons. Freeman didn't share this useful information, however, because he had come on a bounty hunting expedition and wanted to capture Crowley. If he had warned us, we would have prepared for the attack, and Crowley would have seen us mounting guns and sending out patrols. He might have tried to flee the planet, and Freeman did not want that. Freeman had sized up the situation and decided to offer up my platoon as bait. Crowley made his move the following morning. I jumped from my bed and looked out a window in time to see the last remnants of an enormous fireball dissolving into the sunrise. The bomb had demolished Ray Freeman's ship, cutting off our only escape route and destroying our only hope of air support. I turned to throw on my armor. It took me less than 30 seconds to slip on my armor and helmet. I snapped the rifle stock on my M27 and exited my cell. Rickman came running from his cell and the others followed, including Taj Gutman, with his helmet stuck to the top of his head like a hat.
What the hell was that?
Before I could tell Rickman about seeing the fireball, Sergeant Godfrey leaped down the stairs to join us.
Everybody up top! Cover the entrances!
As we reached the top of the barracks, a rocket struck just outside the arched entrance. I peered through the thinning dust cloud. A ring of small fires still burned around the 10-meter wide hole that the rocket had left in our walkway.
Saris, Mervin, Phillips, secure the main hall!
Without so much as a moment's hesitation, three Marines pulled their pistols and charged down that shattered hallway. Mervin and Phillips ran past Saris's body and sprinted through a volley of bullets and laser fire.
Harris, go with them!
Clones like Saris reacted to orders by reflex, but I needed a moment.
Move out!
I leaped over Saris. A few feet ahead of me, Mervin lay on the ground beside the shredded wall. He had been shot in the head, and part of his helmet and visor littered the ground around him. I saw the singed skin and one brown eye, crazy with fear, staring at me.
Harris, what are you doing?
Godfrey was using the communication link built into our helmets.
What are you waiting for?
Mervin's alive.
Forget Mervin. I want that side of the base secured. Do you understand me?
I can get him out of here.
I gave you an order.
Just then, a rocket slammed into the remains of the walkway about 30 feet ahead of me. The breezeway collapsed. The avalanche had dumped me in the courtyard. Kneeling, still dizzy from the blast and winded from the fall, I peered over the waist-high ruins of the outer wall. I scanned the desert and saw four figures crouched along a distant ridge, three men in camouflaged fatigues, and Klein. He still had that grenade glued to his hand. Clearly, Klein had not come to fight. He came to scavenge. As Freeman had suspected, the grenade had worked like a catalyst, forcing Crowley to attack.
Harris! Harris, report!
Just a little shook up.
Not your condition, you idiot! What do you see?
I see some of them. Four of them, 130 yards out.
A tool in my visor measured the distance.
There are three more a few yards to the east.
I don't see... No, there they are. Freeman's right.
There they were, Crowley and two other men standing around a table with a map and some kind of control console. Seeing the console explained a lot. Crowley hadn't come with an army. He'd come with trackers, motion-tracking robots that registered movement in a designated area and fired at that movement with incredible accuracy.
He's got trackers. I can't see them, but I can see the control console.
He had six trackers, four guarding the front wall of the base, one in the west, and one on the east.
You sure about that count?
Crowley has 20 men watching the west wall of the base and 10 to the east. Where are you, Freeman? Are you near the armory? What is your position? Damn it! Where are you, Freeman? Do you have a clean shot at them?
I started to shuffle along the wall to get a better look at Crowley's position.
Do not move, Harris. I see movement out the main gate.
Peering over the wall, I saw three Marines run toward a heap of rocks and dive behind it. Two of the men took cover behind the massive front arch of the outpost and fired.
What the hell are you guys doing?
Get your men out of there!
The top of a tracker popped up from behind a sand dune, and before anyone could react, two rockets came flying toward the arch. The rockets had destroyed the entrance and much of the main hall. From where I stood, I could look directly into Glenn Godfrey's office.
Harris, get to the armory.
I started across the courtyard, cutting through the shallow edges around the stagnant pond area of the courtyard.
Harris, stop! Those trackers have you. Check for scatters with your radar sensors.
Our helmets included a sensor warning system that detected radar devices. I should have switched on the sensor the moment I knew there were trackers outside the wall. I ran the scan and froze in mid-step. A blue ring appeared around the edges of my visor as the sensor kicked in. The ring remained blue for a moment, then turned yellow, then orange. The trackers were bathing the courtyard with radar, and they could only be looking for me. If the ring in my visor turned red, it meant that the sensors had fixed on my location. Orange meant they had detected me, but I had stopped moving before they could fire. I dropped to the ground and felt my knees sink into the mud. I listened for the hiss of incoming rockets as the seconds passed and the ring in my visor fluctuated from yellow to orange and back to yellow again. It never turned blue or red.
Harris, get to the armory.
Crowley doesn't care about the armory. He wants the barracks. We need to attack.
Are you insane? Harris, either get to the armory or get your ass back to the barracks.
They haven't located Freeman, and they have me pinned down in the courtyard. Everybody else is right where Crowley wants them.
Godfrey, you can't hide in the barracks. You're playing into his hands.
Harris, get over here. We'll cover you.
Freeman? Got any suggestions?
Make a break for the northeast corner.
I looked across the yard toward the northeast corner of the outpost, the nearly disintegrated northeast corner where Rickman and Phillips had made their stand. The rockets had destroyed Phillips so thoroughly that his armor did not even register.
You're shitting me, right?
I'll take care of the trackers.
You have a shot at them?
Are you listening, Harris? Get your ass over here.
Leave them to me. Move on the count of three.
Got it.
It's your court, Marshal.
Get specked.
Three.
I climbed to my feet and sprinted. Ahead of me, I saw Freeman leap to the top of a huge pile of rubble. He fired a grenade launcher toward the trackers. No one fired at me, and the sensor rings in my helmet remained blue. I dived headlong and joined Freeman behind the rubble.
Crowley has already left.
How do you know?
Freeman handed me a palm-top computer display that showed Gobi Station and the surrounding landscape. Freeman had either established a link with some satellite tracking our area or placed cameras around the outside of the base. The northern and western walls were ruins. The display showed people as small white ovals.
You placed sensors?
2 days ago.
You only flew in yesterday morning.
Don't you ever wake up? I've been on this damn planet for 3 days now. Came quietly with a second ship in tow. The one they hit was a decoy. My real ship is down in the canyon behind the base. Now I can take you in the hold as far as the next outpost.
I can't leave Gobi.
Have it your way. Don't suppose you would cover me while I make a run for my ship?
I suppose not.
The ship has missiles and a chain gun. Help me get to my ship and I'll fix this.
I don't trust you.
They're moving south. We'll leave a few men to keep us pinned down while the rest of their force flanks the barracks. Godfrey could take them if he had any brains.
He won't. What do you have in mind?
They're gathering around the barracks.
Freeman handed me his computer. Even as I watched, the little ovals representing Crowley's men moved toward the ridges along the barracks.
You storm them here, and I'll go get the ship.
There are 5 men there.
Freeman took back his palm display and said nothing.
Take out 5 men armed with a pistol?
Does the polarizing lens in your helmet work?
It works.
No sooner had I said this than a strange animal dragging a 10-foot train of cloth behind it snaked toward us. Only it wasn't an animal. It was a service drone that Freeman controlled with a small remote. The drone snaked toward us and stopped. Freeman unclipped the thermal blanket he had tied around it and attached a thin silver disc.
You'll want to cover your eyes in a moment.
I watched the little drone pick its way through the debris that had once been the outpost's massive front wall. It disappeared behind the wall, but I could still see it on Freeman's readout as it approached the terrorist bunker. When the drone got within 50 feet of Crowley's men, the little sphere exploded in a chemical flash so bright that it drowned out the desert sun.
Go!
Even looking through polarizing lenses, I could barely see. The Gobi landscape looked faded and white. Over the top of the sand dune, I saw 3 of Crowley's men squirming on the ground, rubbing their eyes with both hands. 2 of Crowley's soldiers had seen the drone coming and shielded their eyes at the last moment. They had sprung from their hiding place and chased Ray Freeman as he ran toward his ship. I hit one of them in the shoulder from over 100 yards away. His friend skidded to a stop and turned to look for me. Freeman's ship must not have been hidden very far away. Moments after he disappeared over the edge of the canyon, a small, spaceworthy flyer that looked like a cross between a bomber and transport rose into the air. From where I stood, I had a clear view of the cockpit, but the glass was mirror tinted and I could not see in. The ship hovered over me for a few moments, then launched across the desert in the direction of Morrowtown. At first I thought Freeman had abandoned the base, but then he doubled back toward the barracks. When he finished, the only man left standing was Klein.
Ah, bastards! You bastards! Are you going to kill me too?
Freeman hovered over the dune and landed his ship in a rippling heat cloud. He climbed out and came over to inspect his work. In the distance, Godfrey emerged from the barracks and started toward us. Freeman stared at Klein with disgust.
Go.
Klein looked down at his hand, then held the grenade out for Freeman.
Oh, please.
Keep it.
Oh.
Klein cradled the grenade against his chest as he staggered into the desert. Admiral Brocious never came to Gobi, but he sent an envoy, Captain James Troy. Troy, with a small army, landed 3 days after the action ended. One at a time, Troy called us all into his ship for 10-minute debriefings. He met with Glenn Godfrey first, then detained him as he met with the other survivors. Freeman and I were the last men called in.
You're gonna be a hero, Freeman. You saved a platoon.
It won't come down like that. All Brocious cares about is that Crowley got away.
Godfrey appeared in the door of the ship wearing his faded uniform.
Think they'll leave him in charge?
Probably. After Gobi, life in a military prison would be a promotion.
How about me?
You'll be the hero. They don't want to talk about some mercenary saving the day. Harris, you never belonged on this planet in the first place. There are people watching over you.
Just then, Godfrey signaled us over. He led us into Troy's flagship. Troy sat behind a large black desk that shone like a mirror. The Cygnus Fleet seal hung on the wall behind him, just above a cluster of flags.
You were the mercenary? Freeman, is it?
That's right.
I suppose you expect payment. As I understand it, you were hired to capture Amos Crowley.
Freeman said nothing. His face betrayed no emotion.
Sergeant Godfrey says you routed the terrorists. I can't imagine why we would pay you good money for saving this sorry pack. As I understand it, Admiral Brocious offered you $25,000 for capturing Crowley. You may continue your manhunt.
Freeman did not say anything.
You were dismissed, Freeman.
Troy turned to me, then pulled a piece of paper from his desk.
And you are?
PFC Harris, sir.
Harris. I understand that you were the only man on this planet who knows his ass from his knees. Sergeant Godfrey said that you ignored orders that would have resulted in the deaths of every man in the platoon. You are hereby promoted to the rank of corporal. I recommended giving you command of Gobi Station, but Admiral Brocious wants you transferred out.
The Unified Authorities government was a synthesis. The U.S. Constitution called for a three-branch representative government with an executive branch, a judicial branch, and a legislative branch. The framers of the UA Constitution kept the judicial branch of the former United States intact, swallowing it whole into their government without a single alteration. The political branches, however, were greatly altered. Plato, that ancient sage, considered democracy little more than rule by a mob and blamed it for the death of Socrates, his mentor. That view suited the designers of the United Authority, who, having conquered the rest of the globe, did not relish giving every citizen an equal voice. In the UA's case, thesis and antithesis merged to create a plutocracy. In a nod to tradition, the Unified Authority retained its capital along the eastern seaboard of the former United States. It was the seat of all galactic politics and the home of all three branches of the federal government. It was also the home of the only voters that carried any authority. With it was the concession that the pro-government historians might one day call the Great Compromise, and the opponents, the beginnings of tyranny. The Senate, clearly the most powerful political body in the Unified Authority, was not composed of members who were elected by popular vote. The House of Representatives, a far less powerful assembly, was. Analysts referred to the two chambers of the legislative branch as the power and the politics. The politics was the House of Representatives, an odd assembly of legislators who truly represented their constituents back in the frontier worlds. The power was the Senate, an august body of lawmakers who had grown up among the population that Plato would have referred to as the ruling class. The elite population of Washington, D.C. Senators were not elected, they were appointed by the Linear Committee, which was the executive branch of the government. New senators were selected from a pool of well-groomed 10th-generation politicians living in the capital city, men and women who had attended elite schools. The executive branch of the government was even more select, called the Linear Committee. This branch was made up of five senior senators. analysts complained about the exclusive nature of this particular club. Only the Linear Committee could appoint new senators, and the Senate chose the members of the Linear Committee from among its ranks. In theory, the Senate ruled the Republic, and the House was filled with figureheads. In truth, the House enjoyed so much popular support from the frontier states that a clever congressman could cause havoc. Looking back, I can see why the Senate was so unpopular. The galactic seat was benevolent, so long as the member states did not openly challenge it. The individual planets could govern themselves as they wished, set up whatever sort of economies and industries they wished, and even create their own militias. What they could not do was break ranks from the Union. Any hint of sedition was dealt with harshly. As long as member states were seen as loyal to the capital, they had nothing to fear. Along with the ruling class, Earth was home to the warrior class. Washington eyed the growing power of the military with a wary eye. But as the Republic pushed deeper into the galaxy, Congress needed a strong arm to maintain order and protect the territories from external threats. Synthetic soldiers were deemed both more manageable and expendable than natural men, so Congress opted for an army of carefully engineered clones. That lent itself well to Plato's view of the military as a class of persons who would never know any life other than that of a soldier. Through neural programming, UA scientists implanted algorithms into their soldiers' brains like code on a computer chip. Generals and politicians collaborated on the cloning project, hammering out the perfect specimen. Soldiers who respected authority and who were strong, patriotic, and ignorant of their origins. Once Congress and the Joint Chiefs had a mix they liked, they set the oven to mass production, cranking out an average of 1.2 million new fighting men every year. Of course, the soldiers did not come out of the vat fully formed. They needed to be raised, formed in the UA military's own image, and indoctrinated with the belief that God charged man to rule the galaxy. Earth became the military processing center, home to 600 all-male orphanages, each of which graduated nearly 2,000 combat-ready orphans per year. The orphanages were little more than clone incubators, though real orphans, like me, were sometimes brought in from the frontier. We were the Flatfoots, the conscripts. No clone or orphan ever reached officer status. The most we could hope for was sergeant. With the exception of some natural-born implants from frontier families, officers came from the ruling class. Children of politicians who did poorly in school or lacked refinement were shunted off to officer training school in Australia, a land that was originally settled as a penal colony. How ironic. With 3 days of liberty before my transfer to the Scutum Crux fleet, I decided to visit the only home I'd ever known, Unified Authority Orphanage No. 553. Located deep in the Olympic Mountains near North America's northwest coast, No. 553 sat between evergreen forests and a major waterway known as the Straits of Juan de Fuca. My home was a brick and steel campus with a 5-acre firing range, a dome-covered parade ground, and a white picket fence. An entrance by permit sign hung over the main gate of the orphanage. I ran my identity card through a reader and the automatic gate slid open, revealing the long dirt road that led to the school. The road stopped at the door of the administrative area, a complex of red brick buildings surrounded by a beautiful meadow. I entered the administration building. Nothing had changed at UAO 553 in the 6 months since my graduation. I walked past the administrative offices, down a hall past several instructional buildings, and past the cafeteria. None of those buildings interested me. After passing the administrative building, I stepped onto the walkway that led past obstacle courses. A squad of students, dressed in red athletic shorts and blue t-shirts, ran across my path. Judging by their size, the boys may have been in their freshman year. Across a sloping hill, a squad of seniors entered the obstacle course. I knew their age because only seniors ran the course wearing combat armor. They needed it. I watched them scale walls, belly crawl under electrical wiring, and fly across gullies using jetpacks. A line of instructors fired M27s with rubber bullets at the boys as they drilled. As I watched, an instructor shot down one of his boys. The kid's arms fell limp, and his jetpack cut off as he flopped to the ground like a wet towel. The instructors ignored him and started firing at other students. I continued toward the tactical training building. Located at the far end of the campus, the TT building looked like a two-story warehouse or possibly an aircraft hangar. The building had no windows, just double-wide steel doors. Some teachers called it the Shed. You could not survive 553 without a mentor. Mine was Alec Oberland, the man in charge of the tactical training simulations. Oberland was the only retired officer on the teaching staff. He fought in historic campaigns, but he never talked about his time on the line. He drilled juniors and seniors with holographic combat situations. His labs looked empty when you entered, but the moment you put on your combat visor, you would find yourself in a vivid and three-dimensional battle in a desert or on an enemy ship. Lasers in our visors projected the scenery into our eyes, painting it on our retinas, and Oberland had simulations of everything from territorial invasions to ship-to-ship combat. He even had programs simulating attacks on Washington, D.C. As I entered the dark front hall of the TT building, I smelled the moldy air conditioning, and my head filled with memories of the fear and rumors the building had inspired. A spiral stairway in the back of the building ran from the basement to the second floor. I squeezed down the stairs, brushing by dozens of students who stopped to admire my uniform. The stairs ended just outside Oberland's classroom. Glad to be back, I opened the door and went in. Oberland stood on a dais at the bottom of the theater, shuffling papers as I approached. He turned toward me as I came down the stairs.
Harris?
Hello, Mr. Oberland.
You're a corporal? You've only been gone for 6 months.
A bit less than that. It's a long story.
I just finished my last class for the day, and I like long stories. Maybe we can talk about it over dinner.
In the teacher's mess?
Unless you know someplace else.
We went to the faculty cafeteria, a cafe-style eatery with square tables and an open buffet line. Though we were early, a few other teachers had already arrived. Oberland placed his books on a table and headed for the food. There were more than one dozen dishes to choose from, casseroles, soups, roast chicken, and salads. There was a dessert bar with fruit, cakes, and chocolates.
I didn't know you teachers ate so well.
We don't. It isn't earth-grown.
Supposedly, earth-grown meats and vegetables tasted better than foods grown on the frontier. I slopped a scoop of beef casserole onto my plate, knowing it would taste better than the vacuum-packed earth-grown MRE chow I ate on Gobi. I took a chicken breast and green salad. We walked over to a table and sat down.
I just got my first transfer.
Transferred? Already? You can't have been at your last assignment for more than a few months.
4 months. Have you ever heard of Gobi?
Never heard of it, but that doesn't mean much. It's a big galaxy. Nice place?
Beautiful skies, a dilapidated base, and toxic water for drinking. Gobi Station is the Marine Corps' smallest outpost. 41 grunts stuck in the middle of nowhere. That was my first assignment.
That sounds like the kind of place they leave you until you die.
I think that might have been the plan, but we saw some unexpected action. A band of malcontents led by a former general attacked our outpost.
Was the general named Amos Crowley?
How do you know Crowley?
I served under Crowley. You know about him, don't you?
No.
Amos Crowley was a brilliant officer.
I don't know about brilliant, but he damn near wiped out Gobi Station. He would have taken us if it had not been for Freeman.
Freeman?
Ray Freeman, a mercenary. Cygnus Command sent him when we reported seeing Crowley.
A mercenary saved your platoon? Please, tell me you're kidding.
You never saw Marines like the ones on Gobi. Men with long hair, men walking around without helmets. One of our guys was so fat, he could not pull his helmet over his head. There was no discipline.
Were they clones?
Yes.
I didn't know that could happen with clones.
Mr. Oberland, these guys were on permanent R&R. They practically lived in the nearest town.
Okay, so the mercenary saved the day. Why were you promoted?
Meritorious service. I helped Freeman while the rest of the platoon hid in the barracks.
And you got a promotion and a transfer.
The transfer was the best part. I've been assigned to the Scutum Crux Fleet, a fighter carrier called the Kamehameha.
The Kamehameha? Not bad, Harris. That's Bryce Kleiber's ship. He's got to be the most powerful man in the military today.
He's not one of the Joint Chiefs.
Oh, no, no, no. That would be Fleet Admiral Kleiber to you. And he is much more powerful than the Joint Chiefs. They're just appointees. Kleiber has friends and family on Capitol Hill. There are some interesting political goings-on in Scutum Crux. One of the planets was just hauled before the Senate.
Galactic news didn't seem all that important back on Gobi. Nothing ever happened there. And nothing that happened anywhere else mattered there.
That's what they told you when you got there?
That's what they told me.
And you still believe them? Wason, a renegade general from a different arm of the galaxy showed up on your planet and tried to blow up your base.
Yeah, I guess so.
You might have known who he was if you kept up with events, Wason. You're going to be on the flagship carrier of the Scutum Crux fleet. Everything you do will have consequences.
And Kleiber?
Admiral Kleiber is the most connected man in the Navy. perform a little meritorious service under his command, and you may be the first enlisted man to earn a commission.